Hi, Dave Emery here. This is Side 1 of For the Record program number 859. Because they can. Update on technocratic fascism. This is being recorded on August 23rd of the year 2015. For the Record programs are recorded in what I guess, for lack of a better term, might be described as hierarchical fashion. If there are people out there who are wondering, what the bleep I mean by technocratic fascism, I'm going to read an excerpt from a very important recent article that I have read into the record several times before. However, I think for a complete understanding of what I mean by technocratic fascism, I think an examination of some of the previous programs using the search function on the SpitfireList.com website will help you out. What we're going to be looking at in this program is the arrogation of an awful lot of what we think of as civil liberties, human rights, and indeed, in many ways, civic life itself to tech companies who are plunging ahead with technologies that are in and of themselves altogether remarkable, and which, when properly applied with, and here's a huge caveat, proper regulation, could be very beneficial to society. However, in the political and social environment in which they are being introduced, an environment in which regulation and adequately large government are very much in disfavor, the net effect of the introduction of these technologies is one of technocratic fascism without anything really resembling democratic process or democratic oversight. These tech companies are acquiring for themselves a tremendous power. The invention of the internet, the weakification of society in particular, the invention of mobile technology and social networking has basically ushered the human race into an entirely different mode or realm of civilization. What Albert Einstein said about the invention of the atomic bomb, I think, applies in many ways to technologies that are coming online today. Einstein observed about the development of the A-bomb, quote, "everything has changed but our way of thinking," unquote. And indeed, I think that is true to a large extent with the world of high tech. I have said so many times in the past in connection with our analysis of the intelligence operation through which or for which Edward Snowden has fronted that basically the NSA, warts and all, is practically speaking the very last thing in the world, or one of the very last things that the average citizen, either in this country or someplace else, really has to worry about. Instead, as we are going to note, people have been surrendering tremendous amounts of information and consequently tremendous control or potential control over their lives to very powerful and yet altogether anonymous entities. And beyond that, with hacking reaching the degree of sophistication that it has, and with society being weakified to the point where automobiles, kitchen appliances, airplanes, nuclear power plants, the power grid itself can all be hacked with destructive results, the development of these technologies could really be said to be something like the sorcerer's apprentice, with the developers of these technologies developing the technologies without any real thought as to what could happen. Either the abuse by the proprietary owners of the technologies and or abuse by hackers who would misuse the technologies by infiltrating and using the information that they get through their illicit infiltration for ill-gotten gains or bad intent. Once again, I'm going to read a short section of a very important article from uncomputing.org of April 23rd of 2015. This is an article called Tor, Technocracy, and Democracy by David Golumbi. That's G as in George, O-L-U-M-B-I-A, from uncomputing.org, again, of April 23rd of 2015. Now, what Golumbi is noting here is that the technologies coming online and the culture associated with it, in particular, libertarian political philosophy married to the Austrian School of Economics, has created a political culture in which coders, anti-establishment coders, as well as the big tech companies themselves, occupy the same basic turf, and that they are arrogating to themselves through their technological capabilities and the technological developments of society. They are arrogating to themselves some very basic political and social rights. Some of this, and I've crystallized this very important article. By the way, the Tor network is an encrypted communications network, supposedly very secure, although there has been a lot of controversy about how secure it actually is. And indeed, it appears that elements of the intelligence community have been involved with developing the Tor network, and there remains something of a question. We will cover this in weeks to come, about how many of the anti-surveillance pro privacy activists are actually associated not only with the intelligence community but with the development of some of these technologies. That, however, in weeks to come. From Tor, Technocracy and Democracy by David Golumbi, we read the following. Technocratic beliefs are widespread in our world today, especially in the enclaves of digital enthusiasts, whether or not they are part of the giant corporate digital leviathan. Hackers, civic, ethical, white, and black hat alike, hacktivists, WikiLeaks fans, and Julian Assange et al., anonymous members, even Edward Snowden himself, walk hand in hand with Facebook and Google in telling us that coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want to do with it, and the rest of us should just stay out of their way. The political world is broken, they appear to think, rightly, at least in part, and the solution to that, they think, wrongly, at least for the most part, is for programmers to take political matters into their own hands. And that basically, into a larger quote, is available in the description for the record, 859. Before we proceed, one point that I will probably fail to explain this adequately, but one of the things that may confuse people for example, when I talk about being very supportive of the NSA in connection with the Snowden operation. Not only is Edward Snowden and Edward Snowden and the people and institutions grouped around him to a large extent actually the opposite of what they represent themselves as being. They are extreme right-wingers or outright fascists who are not promoting human welfare at all. They're out to undermine the government and elements associated with it. The Constitution, to a certain extent, has really become obsolete, at least the Bill of Rights. It's not that I don't support what it says. However, the framers of the Constitution were operating hundreds of years ago, and what they were worried about was absolute monarchy. They didn't want an absolute monarch to be able to dictate to the population arbitrarily and impose his or her will on that population. And that is a principle with which I agree. If I think the framers of the Constitution were to be reincarnated today and observe how a single individual or a group of individuals could subvert a nuclear power plant, cause an airliner to crash, take control of automobiles, perhaps even subverting the entire power grid or a group of nuclear power plants. They would be horrified at the ability of a single individual and an anonymous individual at that to wreak havoc on an entire population, to basically use the potential threat of deadly force over an entire population group, and to do that anonymously. If, for example, a king imposes unjust rule, at least people know who the king is and what they're doing. But if some hacker with a smartphone or a laptop causes a nuclear power plant or more than one to melt down, or causes an airliner to crash in the middle of the city, or brings down the power grid, or interferes with powerful military weapons, systems, people have no concept of who it is that's actually doing this, and yet that individual or small group of individuals is wielding a tremendous and altogether arbitrary power over the population. As we have emerged into a new technological age, I think what we really need is something far more than just the NSA. The NSA should be involved, however, only fulfilling a portion of what, for lack of a better term, might be called a cybersecurity agency or a cyber agency or something along those lines, a cyber affairs agency in which major federal agencies all play a part in attempting to, in theory, give the population some sort of a fighting chance in the new technological landscape. Because indeed, between the big tech companies themselves and the amazing things they are doing, and with the hacker community, who also can do some amazing things by entering into databases and manipulating those databases, often illegally. I guess hacking, period, is illegal, but some of them do that as part of a security function for various institutions. What is needed is some sort of huge regulatory agency. And as it is now, in that David Columbia article, it was pointed out that we are now in a period of time in which not only the giant corporations, but hackers, coders, who can use the new technologies, the emerging technologies, to their own ends, have basically arrogated to themselves the fundamentals of democratic process and civil society. Again, the David Columbia article, I think, really hits the nail on the head when it says, again, in the enclaves of digital enthusiasts, whether or not they are part of the giant corporate digital leviathan, hackers, civic ethical white and black hat alike, hacktivists, WikiLeaks fans, and Julian Assange, anonymous members, and even Edward Snowden himself, walk hand in hand with Facebook and Google in telling us that coders don't just have good things to contribute to the political world, but that the political world is theirs to do with what they want, and the rest of us should just stay out of it. The sheer arrogance that is implicit at a fundamental level, not only in Edward Snowden's actions, where he took some 2.7 million classified documents, which he could not possibly have read, and then gave them to a bunch of private people. WikiLeaks did something very similar. They had over a terabyte of information. They were partnered with, among other institutions, the Russian phishing mafia. That's P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G. Those are the highly sophisticated Russian internet criminals. Stamhouse pointed out that when the WikiLeaks website came online, the Russian phishing mafia was offering up a mirrored website of the WikiLeaks website, so a lot of people who thought they were visiting the WikiLeaks website were in fact visiting the mirrored Russian phishing mafia site. And for a host to host the WikiLeaks site initially, Julian Assange, courtesy of his Holocaust-denying right-hand man, Joram Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, chose the Pirate Bay website financed by Carl Lundstrom, a Swedish fascist who also helped to finance the Sweden Democrats, originally an explicit neo-Nazi party, and now simply one of the anti-immigrant, far-right fascist populist parties that are gaining strength in Europe. That sort of exemplifies what David Columbia is talking about and what I'm talking about here. When you have access to a tremendous amount of information, it is incumbent on the person in possession of it to act responsibly. And Julian Assange sure as hell didn't. WikiLeaks didn't. Edward Snowden didn't. When you look at the interests who have gotten a hold of these things, they are not necessarily responsible at all. Indeed, Edward Snowden gave his information to WikiLeaks. And the wielding of the tremendous power, power derived from public documents, from information that belongs to the public, taking this and giving it to individuals to do with as they see fit, is sort of like the civic equivalent of Aleister Crowley's "Do as thou wilt." It is not good. And so, again, when I'm talking about technocratic fascism, I'm talking about the seizure of civic and political power by coders and people in possession of information.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
An example of the control that our information technology is placing over us, this in the context of one of the most mundane behaviors of people using credit cards, was penned in a post on the ZeroHedge.com website of February 8th of 2015. This article was submitted by Ben Hunt, H-U-N-T. The title is, "The Singularity is Already Here. Its Name is Big Data." And this reads in part, "Last Thursday, the journal Science published an article by four MIT-affiliated data scientists. Sandy Pentland is in the group, and he's a big name in these circles, titled, Unique in the Shopping Mall, on the Re-Identifiability of Credit Card Metadata," unquote. Sounds innocuous enough, but here's the summary from the front page Wall Street Journal article describing the findings. Researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, writing Thursday in the journal Science, analyzed anonymous credit card transactions by 1.1 million people. Using a new analytic formula, they needed only 4 bits of secondary information, metadata such as location or timing, to identify the unique individual purchasing pattern of 90% of the people involved, even when the data was scrubbed of any names, account numbers, or other obvious identifiers. Still not sure what this means. It means that I do not need your name or your address, much less your social security number, to know who you are. With a trivial amount of transactional data, I can figure out where you live, what you do, who you associate with, what you buy, and what you sell. I don't need to steal this data, and frankly, I wouldn't know what to do with your social security number even if I had it. It would just slow down my analysis. No, you give me everything I need just by living your very convenient life, where you volunteered every bit of transactional information in the fine print of all these wondrous devices that you've signed up for. And if there's a bit more information I need, say a device that records and transmits your driving habits, well, you're only too happy to sell that to me for a few dollars off of your insurance policy. After all, you've got nothing to hide. It's free money. Almost every investor I know believes that the tools of surveillance and big data are only used against the marginalized other. Terrorist, quote, sympathizers, unquote, in Yemen, gang, quote, associates, unquote, in Compton, but not us. Oh, no, not us. And if those tools are trained on us, it's only to promote, quote, transparency, unquote, and weed out the bad guys lurking in our midst. Or maybe to suggest a movie we'd like to watch. What could possibly be wrong with that? I've written a lot about what's wrong with that and about how the modern fetish with transparency, aided and abetted by technology and government, perverts the core small-L liberal institutions of markets and representative government. It's not that we're complacent about our personal information. On the contrary, we are obsessed about the personal keys, unquote, that are meaningful to humans, names, social security numbers, passports, and the like, and we spend billions of dollars and millions of hours every year to control those keys to prevent them from falling into the wrong hands of other humans. But we willingly hand over a different set of keys to non-human hands without a second thought. The problem is that our human brains are wired to think of data processing in human ways, and so we assume that computerized systems process data in these same human ways, albeit more quickly and more accurately. Our science fiction is filled with computer systems that are essentially godlike human brains, machines that can talk and, quote, think, unquote, and manipulate physical objects as if sentience in a human context is the pinnacle of data processing. This anthropomorphic bias drives me nuts as it dampens both the sense of awe and the sense of danger we should be feeling of what already walks among us. It seems like everyone and his brother today are wringing their hands about artificial intelligence and some impending singularity, unquote. A moment of future doom where non-human intelligence achieves some humanesque sentience and decides in matrix-like fashion to turn us into batteries or some such. Please, the singularity is already here. Its name is Big Data. Big Data is actually magic in the sense that Arthur C. Clarke built a sufficiently advanced technology. It's magic in the way that thermonuclear bombs and television are not, because for all the complexity of these inventions, they are driven by cause and effect relationships in the physical world that the human brain can process comfortably. Physical world relationships that might not have existed on the African savanna 2 million years ago, but are understandable with the sensory and neural organs our ancestors evolved on that savanna. Big data systems do not see, unquote, the world as we do, with merely three dimensions of physical reality. Big data systems are not social animals evolved by nature and trained from birth to interpret all signals through a social lens. Big data systems are sui generis, a way of perceiving the world that may have been invented by human ingenuity and can serve human interests, but are utterly non-human and profoundly not of this world. A big data system couldn't care less if it has your specific social security number or your specific account ID, because it's not understanding who you are based on how you identify yourself to other humans. That is the human bias here, that a big data system would try to predict our individual behavior based on an analysis of what we individually had done in the past, as if the computer was some super advanced version of Sherlock Holmes. No. What a big data system can do is look at all of our behaviors across all dimensions of that behavior and infer what any of us would do under similar circumstances. It's a simple concept, really, but what the human brain can't easily comprehend is the vastness of the all part of the equation, or what it means to look at the all simultaneously and in parallel. I've been working with inference engines for almost 30 years now, and while I think that I've got unusually good instincts for this, and I've been able to train my brain to kind of sort of think in multidimensional terms, the truth is that I only get glimpses of what's happening inside these engines. I can channel the magic, I can appreciate the magic, and on a purely symbolic level, I can describe the magic. But on a fundamental level, I don't understand the magic, and neither does any other human. What I can say to you with absolute certainty, however, is that the magic exists, and there are plenty of magicians like me out there, with more graduating from MIT and Harvard and Stanford every year. In exactly the same way that we have given away our personal behavioral data to banks and credit card companies and wireless carriers and insurance companies and a million app providers, and I would add parenthetically, and big tech itself, Google, Yahoo, Facebook, Apple et al. So are we now being tempted to give away our portfolio behavioral data to mega banks and mega asset managers and the technology providers who work with them? Don't worry, they say, there's nothing in this information that identifies you directly. It's all anonymous. What rubbish. With enough anonymous portfolio behavioral data and a laughably small IT budget, any competent magician can design a big data system that can predict with 90% accuracy what you will buy and sell in your account, at what price you will buy and sell, and under what external macro conditions you will buy and sell. Every day, these private data sets at the mega market players get bigger and bigger, and every day we get closer and closer to a citadel or a renaissance perfecting their inference machine for the liquid capital markets. For all I know, they already have. And again, what the writer here in Zero Hedge itself has something of a libertarian editorial stance that I most assuredly do not agree with. However, they also feature some worthy posts, such as this one here. And the point that is being made is that basically people are surrendering their data, and they are surrendering their information willingly and enthusiastically even to technocrats who are using that information for their own ends. And indeed, some of the technocrats described in the David Columbia article, again, people from the hackers themselves who arrogate to themselves the right to accumulate and use other people's data, things that do not actually belong to the hacker or hackers, to the very big tech companies themselves who are vacuum cleaning every last piece of information they can about people's lives. We are handing control over our civilization to people who have no elected authority whatsoever. They have been given the keys to the kingdom, and really, although one could not call us an absolute monarchy, we have basically created a technocratic fascism of a type, with technocrats having, in some cases, been given, in some cases, arrogating to themselves power over the rest of us, and acquiring that power through their technological means and their skills, having nothing whatsoever to do with democratic process or the consent of the governed or the hacked or the apt or whatever you want to call it. Considering the possibilities here, now bear in mind what the author there, Ben Hunt, was talking about in terms of the ability of people with the right technological analytical tools to identify people, anonymous people, just based on a very small amount of data concerning their credit card purchases. And for people who think that these tech inventions are benevolent things and that they're going to lead to good things, consider what we are about to examine.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker TerraFractal, specializing in, but by no means exclusively, economic and financial matters.
The next several articles, I think, should be considered in the context of the meltdown, the financial meltdown that took place in 2008. In that regard, I would cite several programs, including For the Record 412, called The Engineer Intends to Correct the Train. In early June of 2003, I basically stated that the enormous deficits that were being run up by the Bush administration were being run up deliberately in order to produce a financial crisis that would then serve as the foundation for an assault on entitlements that people would not otherwise willingly surrender, things like Social Security and Medicare. I will also note an article or a program, I think it was For the Record 531, in which we interviewed Lewis, Lucy Commissar, and talked about AIG many years before AIG collapsed and needed a federal bailout. In light of what has since become known as the bankster community, and in light of what we now know about the 2008 financial collapse, consider some of the following. And again, the Ben Hunt post from Zero Hedge and the David Columbia article from uncomputing.org should be kept in mind here. Facebook users, I hope you are having a good time with your Facebook apps, because there is something very interesting on the horizon. And again, consider this in light of what we have already examined. This is from the MikeMIC.com blog of August 5th of 2015. It's by Jack Smith IV. Facebook's new plan: help banks figure out how poor you are so they can deny you loans. Well, what really is implicit in what I'm about to read to you is that this new app will enable banks to determine how poor your friends are and to deny you a loan based on their credit unworthiness. Doesn't that sound fair? Doesn't that sound democratic? Again, from Mike.com, August 5th, 2015, Jack Smith IV, Facebook's new plan: help banks figure out how poor you are so they can deny you loans. It reads in part, if you and your Facebook friends are poor, good luck getting approved for a loan. Facebook has registered a patent for a system that will let banks and lenders screen your social network before deciding whether or not you're approved for a loan. If your Facebook friends' average credit scores don't make the cut, the bank can reject you on that basis. The patent is worded in clear, terrifying language that speaks for itself. When an individual applies for a loan, the lender examines the credit ratings of members of the individual's social network who are connected to the individual through authorized nodes. If the average credit rating of these members is at least a minimum credit score, the lender continues to process the loan application. Otherwise, the loan application is rejected. It is, very literally, guilt by association, allowing banks and lenders to profile you by the status of your loved ones. Though a credit score isn't necessarily a reflection of your wealth, it can serve as a rough guideline for who has a reliable managed income and who has had to lean on credit in trying times. And skipping down. A bold new era for discrimination. In the U.S., it's illegal to deny someone a loan based on traditional identifiers like race or gender, the kinds of things people usually use to discriminate. But these laws were made before Facebook was able to peer into your social graph and learn when, where, and how long you've known your friends and acquaintances. Profiling people for being in social circles where low credit scores are likely could cut off someone's chances of finding financial relief. In effect, it's a device that isolates the poor and keeps them poor. The fitness tracking tech company Fitbit said in 2014 that the fastest growing part of their business is helping employers monitor the health of their employees. Once insurers show interest in this information, you can bet they'll be making a few rejections of their own. And if a group insurance plan that affects every employee depends on measurable, real-time data for the fitness of its employees, how will that affect the hiring process? And indeed, if you sign in on this, this Facebook app, and if you get turned down for credit, that could be very easily on the basis of the people you know. Perhaps, maybe, again, some people may think I'm overreacting when I talk about the new era of civilization and the fundamental danger to everything we consider to be human liberty or rights that has been implemented, that is being brought about by these technologies. Just examine that. Facebook, that wonderful, groovy new social media site, now has an app that will enable you to be turned down for credit on the basis of the credit unworthiness of your friends and or loved ones. And again, consider that in connection with the post from Zero Hedge by Ben Hunt, in which analysts with the right programs, when just four small bits of anonymous metadata could predict with a high degree of precision what people were going to do in terms of their purchases and credit operations. And consider again, at the same time as Facebook, and again, the top stockholder in Facebook is Peter Thiel, who is also the top stockholder, shareholder, I should say, in Palantir that makes the Prism software. Peter Thiel also is the number one bankroller of Ron Paul's candidacy. That is Edward Snowden's candidate of choice. And Snowden's first attorney was the top legal advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 campaign. By the way, we're going to talk about some alleged campaign violations by Ron Paul's 2012 campaign and how Google is riding to the rescue of Ron and Rand Paul. That, however, in a show that will be upcoming. As things are becoming more and more transparent and resultingly more perilous for the average Facebook user or for anyone in general out there, the reverse is becoming the case for many of the very large financial institutions that were at the core of the meltdown. By the way, I would recommend a wonderful documentary called Inside Job about the financial meltdown. If people think that this was some sort of huge blunder, this was a result of willful greed, and people knew it was coming. It was deliberately engineered. And I strongly recommend the documentary Inside Job about the 2008 financial meltdown. So as people who use Facebook are putting in this app that will enable them to get turned down for credit because of their friends or loved ones, the reverse is becoming the case for the banksters, the big financial institutions, who now have technology at their disposal, which will make their operations largely opaque to the very regulators, whose oversight is fundamental to prevent another disaster. There is a messaging system called Symphony that is now being made available to large financial institutions, and it is encrypted end-to-end. And although it stores the information, it basically is opaque to scrutiny by an outsider, and certain key elements of information are automatically deleted by this network. The problem here, of course, is can regulators adequately access information that is communicated on the end-to-end encrypted Symphony messaging service in order to prevent abuses? From the Financial Times of July 22nd of 2015 by Ben McClanahan and Gina Chon, G-I-N-A, last name C-H-O-N, New York regulator sends message to Symphony, unquote. New York State's banking regulator has fired a shot across the bows of Symphony, a messaging service about to be launched by a consortium of Wall Street banks and asset managers by calling for information on how it manages and deletes customer data. In a letter on Wednesday to David Gurley, G-U-R-L-E, the chief executive of Symphony Communication Services, the New York Department of Financial Services asked it to clarify how its tool would allow firms to erase their data trails, potentially falling foul of laws on record-keeping. The letter, which was signed by Acting Superintendent Anthony Albanese and shared with the press, noted that chat room transcripts had formed a critical part of authorities' investigations into the rigging of markets for foreign exchange and interbank loans. It called for Symphony to spell out its document retention capabilities, policies, and features, citing two specific areas of interest as data deletion and end-to-end encryption, unquote. The letter marks the first expression of concern from regulators over a new initiative that is set out to challenge the dominance of Bloomberg, whose 320,000-plus subscribers ping about 200 million messages a day between terminals using its communication tools. People familiar with the matter describe the inquiry as an information-gathering exercise, which could conclude that Symphony is a perfectly legitimate enterprise. The regulators noted that Symphony's marketing material state that, quote, Symphony has designed a specific set of procedures to guarantee that data deletion is permanent and fully documented. We also delete content on a regular basis in accordance with customer data retention policies. Skipping down again. Mr. Albanese also wrote that he would follow up with four consortium members that the NYDFS regulates: Bank of New York, Mellon, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, and Goldman Sachs. How about these names? Bank of New York, Mellon, basically the Mellon, New York branch of the Mellon Bank, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank, and Goldman Sachs. Deeply involved, of course, in the shenanigans of 2008, or the shenanigans that came to a head in 2008. Mr. Albanese is going to ask them how they plan to use the new service, which will go live for big customers in the first week of August. The regulator said it was keen to find out how banks would ensure that messages created using Symphony would be retained and, quote, whether their use of Symphony's encryption technology can be used to prevent review by compliance personnel or regulators, unquote. It also flagged concerns over the open source features of the product, wondering if they could be used to, quote, circumvent oversight, unquote. And another story about the Symphony app, this from the New York Business Journal of August 13th of 2015 by Michael Del Castillo. Symphony, the WhatsApp for Wall Street, orchestrates a nuanced response to regulatory critics. Symphony is taking some heat in Washington, D.C. for its WhatsApp like messaging service that promotes, that promises to encrypt Wall Street's messages from end to end. At the heart of the concern is whether or not the keys used to encrypt the messages will be made available to regulators, or if another form of backdoor access will be provided. Without such keys, it would be immensely more difficult to retrace the steps of shady characters on Wall Street during regulatory investigations, an ability which, according to a New York Post report, has resulted in $74 billion in fines over the past 5 years. So again, while Facebook is making it easier for financial institutions to turn you down for credit based not on your own creditworthiness, but the credit ratings of your friends and or loved ones, things are going in the opposite direction for the major financial institutions, which are now going to get access to technology which will have end-to-end encryption, and which, although they promised to store automatically information that will be required by regulators, it is unclear if regulators themselves will be able to get in and actually examine the information which they need in order to do an effective and intelligent job.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site also features many articles not included in programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Something that is, I think, as symptomatic of our technocratic fascism and our sorcerer's apprentice willingness to just rush into things willy-nilly is Bitcoin, which is called actually a digital currency. It's actually just computer code. It is completely unregulated. And in the four programs just about Bitcoin that I've done today, For the Record 760, For the Record 764, I think For the Record 772 and 785, or 770 and 785, the remarkable aspects of Bitcoin, I think, it should scare the you-know-what out of you in that people actually give this thing some credibility. But suffice it to say, a completely unregulated digital, quote, currency, unquote, that is open to random manipulation by these technocrats, well, it is turning into a scam and a half. But now there has been a new technological development with Bitcoin, which will enable several interesting things. First of all, it will facilitate the use of Bitcoin and the internet for illegal purposes, including putting out murder contracts anonymously on public figures. It also will enable other types of cybercrime, and some of the functions that this new variant on Bitcoin will permit will go toward eliminating various types of attorneys who are actually required for certain types of financial transactions. So, for those of you who still crave after Bitcoins, just remember my caveat that it is fool's gold. From MIT Technology Review of August 13th to 2015, an article by Tom Simonite, S-I-M-O-N-I-T-E, Bitcoin's dark side could get darker, unquote. Reads in part, investors see riches in a cryptography-enabled technology called smart contracts, but it could also offer much to criminals. Some of the earliest adopters of the digital currency Bitcoin were criminals who found it invaluable in online marketplaces for contraband and as payment extorted through lucrative ransomware, unquote, that holds personal data hostage. A new Bitcoin-inspired technology that some investors believe will be much more useful and powerful may be set to unlock a new wave of criminal innovation. That technology is known as smart contracts, small computer programs that can do things like execute financial trades or notarize documents in a legal agreement. Intended to take the place of third-party human administrators such as lawyers, which are required in many deals and agreements, they can verify information and hold or use funds using similar cryptography to that which underpins Bitcoin. Some companies think smart contracts could make financial markets more efficient or simplify complex transactions such as property deals. Ari Jules, a cryptographer and professor at the Jacobs Technicon Cornell Institute at Cornell Tech, believes they will also be useful for illegal activity, and with two collaborators, he has demonstrated how. In a paper to be released today, Jules, fellow Cornell professor Elaine Shi, S-H-I, and University of Maryland researcher Ahmed Kosba, K-O-S-B-A, present several examples of what they call criminal contracts, unquote. They wrote them to work on the recently launched smart contract platform Ethereum. One example is a contract offering a cryptocurrency reward for hacking a particular website. Ethereum's programming language makes it possible for the contract to control the promised funds. It will release them only to someone who provides proof of having carried out the job in the form of a cryptographically verifiable string added to the defaced site. Contracts with a similar design could be used in commission of many kinds of crimes, said the researchers. Most provocatively, they outline a version designed to arrange the assassination of a public figure. A person wishing to claim the bounty would have to send information such as the time and place of the killing in advance. The contract would pay out after verifying that those details had appeared in several trusted news sources, such as newswires. A similar approach could be used for lesser physical crimes, such as high-profile vandalism. Quote, it was a bit of a surprise to me that these types of crimes in the physical world could be enabled by a digital system, unquote, says Jules. He and his co-authors say they are trying to publicize the potential for such activity to get technologists and policymakers thinking about how to make sure the positives of smart contracts outweigh the negatives. Gavin Wood, Chief Technology Officer at Ethereum, notes that legitimate businesses are already planning to make use of his technology, for example, to provide a digitally transferable proof of ownership of gold. However, Wood acknowledges that it is likely that Ethereum will be used in ways that break the law, and even says that is part of what makes the technology interesting. Just as file sharing found widespread unauthorized use and forced changes in the entertainment and tech industries, illicit activity enabled by Ethereum could change the world, he says. The potential for Ethereum to alter aspects of society is of significant magnitude, says Wood. This is something that would provide a technical basis for all sorts of social changes that I find that exciting, unquote. And skipping down about what this can do, you can implement any web service without there being a legal entity behind it, he says. The idea of making certain things impossible to legislate against is really interesting, unquote. Well, that sounds delightful, doesn't it? I think particularly interesting, they're going to provide, use these small contracts or smart contracts to provide digitally transferable proof of ownership of gold. Just check out Gold Warriors by the Seagraves, and, well, this will be very, very fun indeed. And this is a much... There's a lot more in this article to contemplate. And again, we're proceeding into things that we really have not thought about very much at all. I have noted with some wry amusement the advent of the Ashley Madison website. It basically enables people who want to have extramarital affairs to do this online. And I just, I don't know. I mean, if you're planning on playing around, I just wouldn't go to the internet to do that. The internet is a public forum, and it doesn't matter what you're going to be doing online, whether it's banking or wanking, it's going to be in public view. And guess what? I'm not going to read you the whole story, but you can just imagine what fun this is going to be. From the Gizmodo website of August 21st, 2015, an article by Adam Clark Estes, E-S-T-E-S, extortionists are after the Ashley Madison users, and they want Bitcoin. And what's happening is that the Ashley Madison website has been hacked, and people are holding people's information and their identities hostage for getting Bitcoins. And surprise, surprise. I mean, it really amazes me that people could be shocked that something like this is going on. Again, I don't care what you're going to be doing online, whether it's banking or wanking, it's going to be known to people. So don't do anything stupid. And speaking of not doing anything stupid, having the Internet of Things may be very stupid indeed. Op-ed piece from the New York Times is going to wrap things up for us this evening. This is from the New York Times of August 10th of 2015, an op-ed column by Zeynep Tufekci, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, Zeynep, T-U-F as in Frank, E-K, C as in Charlie, I. Why smart objects may be a dumb idea. I don't know if you've heard about the Internet of Things, but all I can say is the Sorcerer's Apprentice is indeed charming the broomstick. A fridge that puts milk on your shopping list when you run low. A safe that tallies the cash that is placed in it. A sniper rifle equipped with advanced computer technology for improved accuracy. A car that lets you stream music from the internet. All of these innovations sound great until you learn the risks that this type of connectivity carries. Recently, two security researchers sitting on a couch and armed only with laptops remotely took control over a Chrysler Jeep Cherokee speeding along the highway, shutting down its engine as an 18-wheeler truck rushed toward it. They did this all while a Wired reporter, that is to say, a reporter for Wired magazine, was driving the car. Their expertise would allow them to hack any Jeep as long as they knew the car's IP address, its network address on the internet. They turned the Jeep's entertainment dashboard into a gateway to the car's steering, brakes, and transmission. A hacked car is a high-profile example of what can go wrong with the coming Internet of Things, objects equipped with software and connected to digital networks. The selling point for these well-connected objects is added convenience and better safety. In reality, it is a fast-motion train wreck in privacy and security. The early internet was intended to connect people who already trusted one another, like academic researchers or military networks. It never had the robust security that today's global network needs. As the internet went from a few thousand users to more than 3 billion, attempts to strengthen security were stymied because of cost, short-sightedness, and competing interests. Connecting everyday objects to this shaky, insecure base will create the internet of hacked things. This is irresponsible and potentially catastrophic. That smart safe, for example, hackers can empty it with a single USB stick while erasing all logs of its activity, the evidence of deposits and withdrawals, and of their crime. That high-tech rifle, researchers managed to remotely manipulate its target selection without the shooters knowing. Home builders and car manufacturers have shifted to a new business, the risky world of information technology. Most seem utterly out of their depth. Although Chrysler recalled 1.4 million Jeeps to patch this particular vulnerability, it took the company more than a year after the issue was first noted, and the recall occurred only after that spectacular publicity stunt on the highway and after it was requested by a National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. In announcing the software fix, the company said that no defect had been found. If two guys sitting on their couch turning off a speeding car's engine from miles away doesn't qualify, parenthetically, in front of a speeding 18-wheeler, continuing, I'm not sure what counts as a defect in Chrysler's world. And Chrysler is far from the only company compromised. From BMW to Tesla to General Motors, many other motor brands have been hacked, with surely more to come. Dramatic hacks attract the most attention, but the software errors that allow them to occur are ubiquitous. While complex breaches can take real effort, the Jeep hacker duo spent 2 years researching, simple errors in the code can also cause significant failure. Adding software with millions of lines of code to the Internet of Things is also a privacy nightmare. Databases that already have too much information about us will now be bursting with data on the places we've driven, the food we purchased, and more. Last week at DEF CON, the annual information security conference, researchers set up an Internet of Things village to show how they could hack everyday objects like baby monitors, thermostats, and security cameras. Connecting everyday objects introduces new risks if done at mass scale. Take that smart refrigerator. If a single fridge malfunctions, it's a hassle. However, if the fridge's computer is connected to its motor, a software bug or hack could brick millions of them all at once, turning them into plastic pantries with heavy doors. Cars, two-ton metal objects designed to hurtle down highways, are already bracingly dangerous. The modern automobile is run by dozens of computers that most manufacturers connect using a system that is old and known to be insecure. Yet automakers often use that flimsy system to connect all of the car's parts. That means once a hacker is in, she's in everywhere: engine, steering, transmission, and brakes, not just the entertainment system. For years, security researchers have been warning about the dangers of coupling so many systems in cars. Alarmed, researchers have published academic papers, hacked cars as demonstrations, and begged the industry to step up. So far, the industry response has been to nod politely and fix exposed flaws without fundamentally changing the way they operate. And skipping down. It isn't hopeless. We can make programs more reliable and databases more secure. Critical functions on internet-connected objects should be isolated and external audits managed to catch problems early. But this will require an initial investment to forestall future problems, the exact opposite of the current corporate impulse. It also may be that not everything needs to be networked, and that the trade-off in vulnerability isn't worth it. And indeed, just imagine what David Columbia wrote about and what Ben Hunt wrote about in the first article, the second article behind the David Columbia article. And consider where we are going and who in bloody hell is going to be seeing to it that the Sorcerer's Apprentice does not muck things up royally for all of us. This concludes For the Record program number 859, Because They Can, update on Technocratic Fascism. This has been recorded on August 23rd of the year 2015. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.